conocido por el mismo ragatanga. El DJ que lo conoce toca el himno de las 12 para Diego, la canción más deseada. Y la baila, y la goza, y la canta. Me gusta de brujería que no encuentre todos los días por donde voy caminando. Me gusta de chulería y este punto de alegría arrastra para profitano. Y los demás no van a un alma y se me ya darse caña poseído por el ritmo de la tanga. El DJ que lo conoce toca el himno de las 12 para Diego, la canción más deseada. Y la baila, y la goza, y la canta.
To reach Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
You know what? If what we're doing these days with clones and creation of life and all the rest of it isn't enough to stand the hair on the back of your neck straight up, this photograph on my website right now is. This is one of the best or the worst, depending on your point of view. I always have to add that I've ever seen. I mean, this is just raw stuff. It's went up about 10 minutes ahead of airtime, like most things. It's totally bad. I mean, this is, again, no reflection on this man's father. He believes it to be the image of his father, and he thinks there's no mistaking it. But I don't know, man. I look at that face. And again, no offense, sir, but we're talking pure evil here. This looks like pure evil to me, the real McCoy evil, you know. Maybe it was just a fellow's attitude in life, the grumpiness. He said grumpiness, that's a pretty mild word. This is really bad. It's under what's new at artbell.com right now. You're going to want to take a look at this. Something as horrible as this photograph is, I just noticed something else about it. God, it's an evil-looking entity. It would appear to be at the top of a stairwell in what is said to be a remodeled area, and it looks like it's halfway through the wall. No, it's three-quarters of the way through the wall on the visual side. The other quarter of it, I don't think you can see. I could be wrong about that, but it looks like it's partway through the wall or door or whatever is there at the top of this stairwell. This thing is pretty awful. In the world of awful, you know, it's like 10 on a scale of 10. www.artbell.com. It will be the first item under what's new. Let me see. Yep. Dad's Ghost Appears in Photo is what you want to click on when you get there. And also check out the CD that allows you to actually own artbell.com. As it rolls into its last 30 days of history. And there is a lot of history associated with this website. First time caller line, you are on the air. Hello.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm just a girl from Nevada.
Just a girl from Nevada?
Who has a story.
I want to tell you a little story.
Thank you.
Very quickly. As you know, I'm in Nevada, too. I'm in Pahrump, Nevada.
Yes, I do.
Did you know that Pahrump, Nevada, as part of Nye County, has legal brothels?
Oh, yes, sir, I do.
You did know that. I think a lot of the country knows that. There are people who have fun at our expense here in Pahrump. And you know what they call young Pahrumpian women?
What would that be?
Brothel sprouts. Isn't that awful? Brothel sprouts. Oh, God, of course it's not true.
Well, that's pretty cute. Pretty cute. It's a nice way to put it, isn't it?
Anyway, hon, what's up?
Well, I've been trying to get in touch with someone just recently in the past couple of years, which included the first time Stephen Greer, then Whitley Strieber, and then actually yourself. But I seem to move right after, and I've lost contact, so nobody could actually have gotten back with me anyway. What I wanted to say was, especially since Robert Lazar just was on the other day.
Bob Lazar, yes.
Yes. Well, back in the 70s, about 76 or so, I met him.
You met Bob?
I met him while I was dealing blackjack in a small town outside. It was in Mesquite.
He is an incredible person.
Oh, yes, but I have more than just having met him. We have a long version, we have a short version, we have an exciting one, or I could just tell you the facts. Let's go. Tell me as we go, okay?
You pick the one you like and go.
I've never done this before, so let's just go for it.
That's right.
Okay, well, you asked me the questions that don't make sense, but it was like 1976 or so, and I was dealing blackjack in a little place in Mesquite, and you get to know everybody there in a small town. Of course, I'm from Pennsylvania. It's the first time I've ever done anything like dealing with blackjack in Mesquite.
Okay, well, so, let's get to the Bob Lazar part.
Well, there I was doing it, and I knew he wasn't from there, and I said, hey, what are you passing through? He says, no, I work down the road. I said, oh. I said, well, gee, the Chicken Ranch? He says, that's the only thing out there.
Yeah.
He says, no. He says, there's a base out there I work on. And I said, oh, you mean you're with Nellis? He says, well, no, not really. It's sort of a private base.
Now this is very interesting because it validates to some degree Bob Lazar's story. As you know, a lot of people cast aspersions on the story that he ever worked out there, and they expunged all records, virtually making him into a non-person. So if he actually told you that offhand,
yes.
That's kind of some interesting corroboration for what he said.
I have a whole lot more, sir.
I'll keep going.
Okay, so I have been afraid to talk about this because I knew he was a non-person, and my family encouraged me not to. And this has been a very long time, and I just can't take it anymore.
Keep going.
Mr. Lazar said, I work out there. I said, well, what do you do? And he says, I'm a rocket scientist. I said, yeah, and I've been visited by aliens. He says, no, I really am.
Yes.
I said, well, no, I really have, which led us into my belief, the fact that I believed in ships, in aliens, and felt I had been contacted throughout my life myself.
Yes.
Therefore, he proceeded. He said, he could show me real ships and that they were working on recreating models that they had. I said, yeah, right. I said, prove it. What time you get off? 11. Okay. He and I then proceeded out somewhere from Mesquite, and I really wasn't sure where I was. It was very dark. I thought I went to the left side of the road, which would have been the south where the Nellis Air Force Base, in my mind.
Do you normally get in cars and go to remote locations with people who say they've seen alien craft? Just a question.
Well, Mr. Lazar seemed so unviolent and unoffensive and on all those words that most men are.
Yeah, he is very unaffected, yes.
That I took him to be exactly at his word.
I mean, you know, telling a good-looking lady, a blackjack dealer, a story like this, it ranks right up there beyond what's your sign. That's
well,
for sure.
I'm sorry, but I have been...
So he took you out into the middle of, no doubt, Area 51 or near it or something.
We got further, sir.
Did you get near S4?
I saw signs with that. I saw they're going to shoot you if you go any further. I remember seeing the black mailbox that you turned at.
Oh, yes.
We proceeded up to a mountain, and we went up there, and he had me walking way up there, and we'd already been gone a long time. I looked over it, and he goes, there it is. There's Groom Lake. Well, I'm looking for a lake.
Yeah.
I don't see a lake, but I see buildings, and they're, like, way far off, and we're not even there yet.
Uh-huh.
We get back into his car.
Yes.
And we start to proceed. As we do so, when I missed, like, the mailbox turns and all that, I don't remember, and we did stop at the Alien Inn on the way in, but... Anyway, we get up there, and as we go to leave down the mountain to go further, he says, you want to go further? I said, yes. They stopped us with these, like, light green or yellow blazers.
Uh-huh.
And security came up to the car, and I was hiding in the back under something, and he knew who he was. So he let us proceed.
Bob Lazar was recognized and allowed to proceed.
Yes, sir. I was really scared then because...
Would you like to give us your first name?
It's true, so I think it would be good if I did.
Just give me your first name.
Paulette.
Paulette, all right. That really is your name?
That really is my name.
All right, Paulette, because I'm going to be asking Bob about this.
That's what I want.
Okay.
That's
all right.
What I want.
All right. All right, Paulette, let's keep going.
He
was allowed to proceed. You were hiding in the back of the car. Then what?
Yes. And I thought this was all, like, silly until that moment. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And then I was scared. I said, oh, my gosh, I'm hiding in the back. And we are now, you know, these guys are serious. Okay. And they were scared.
Oh, they are serious.
So we proceeded up to, turned right into, and I saw this long field. And on the left side was a large hangar with a couple large doors and a small door to walk into. And at the end of the field, which I'm still looking for a lake, it's some kind of landing strip. At the end of it is some kind of tower I could see. And we stopped the car and we entered into the building of the hangar where the ships were.
You got in that building?
Yes, sir.
And you saw the ships?
Yes.
Describe
yes.
to me and everybody what you saw, please.
Okay. Well, it was kind of dark in there because he just turned on the lights up towards the front.
Gotcha.
But as we walked in, I remember a little ha-ha because they had those, like, people movers that they, those velvet things and the gold poles that they have where movie theaters are.
Right.
And I laughed. I thought, yeah, this is going to get people away from here. Ha-ha, you know. Anyway, there was a cigarette-shaped one, a cigar-shaped one first. Then in the middle was a little round kind of a teardrop-looking thing, like a little helicopter without its top. And the third one is the one that I actually saw more of and entered into.
You entered this craft?
Yes. The third one was made of sort of, it looked like wings of a butterfly that you could look through. It had like little veins going through it, and I remember it to be a yellow.
Okay.
I remember seeing hieroglyphic-type markings. It was very small. I'm 5'2" and I had to bend over and crawl in.
So it was obviously meant for small beings.
Yes, sir.
Of some sort. All right.
What clicked my memory on this, which I have to remember that after this all happened, I had no memory of this till about 12 years ago. And when I heard a report on TV in Vegas that talked about someone talking about a sports model.
Right.
I remember the third ship, and I thought to myself when I saw it, he said, this is our sports model. And in fact, that when I wrote my letter to somebody, I wrote that he said, this is our compact model. But it, I think the word was sport. And I thought to myself, that's the economy model. And I thought, no, that's not the economy model, because you don't need fuel in space, because everything works in wheels within wheels and reverse gravity.
So he got you in and he got you out.
No, wait. They let us out. He was caught just like I was.
Well, I'm sure he will. How did the two of you get caught? And,
okay.
And what were you doing when you got caught?
Well, I was in the little ship looking around, goofing around, and he was kind of just down, I don't know, down where we walked in before we went up, walked into the ship area.
Yes.
And there was like a little, there was a hall. And then there was that cage look like you used to have on Taxi where that guy, fat guy sat in.
Yes.
And right next to it, there was a hallway, and right next to it was a large plate window. I went over to the plate window, and I remember seeing some type of alien body of some type or something.
Oh, my God.
Now,
you see, Bob has never admitted to having seen either bodies or aliens
now,
at all.
Now, this is part of my memory that I would like clearer, sir. Because I have been, what happened is they did something to my memory. So I don't have all the details.
Well, what keyed bringing all this back? I mean, you just
hearing things.
Well, yeah.
Bob Lazar's interview.
Hearing the sports model and so forth. That was like heated
it
off. That's when it began.
It off.
All right, gotcha.
So let me say this. I will not swear that at that point I saw a body there, but this is the images that came from my thoughts of that time. So I'm not going to swear at that moment.
All right, what do you know about after you were caught?
I mean, okay, that's what I mean. At that point, they zapped us or something, and I remember being...
Us? You mean they zapped Bob as well?
Yes. They took both of us, and we were taken through this area where that's where I remember the aliens working on these little, like, they were all working on carburetors or something, you know what I mean? They were all working on something, and they all looked alike, and they were all in a row, and they were all doing the same thing. And as they took our bodies through to this back room, we went up, and all of a sudden, I mean, there's time that I don't remember, of course.
All right.
I woke up, Bob Lazar, myself, and two other couples were connected to a machine with electrodes on it, standing in front of a military man, which was standing in front of a large glass window, and he had a desk. And I said to him, please, I said, let us go. We won't say anything. Uh-huh. And we were nude. And I remember looking over at Bob Lazar. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, this is so embarrassing, you know. And then I thought, well, he don't look so good himself. So I guess I don't have to feel that bad.
Oh, my God.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Do you swear all of this is true?
I swear to God. The only thing I'm not sure because of my other times I was taken. I'm not positive of the bodies, but I know of everything else.
All right. That's fair. I mean,
okay,
you're clear on that. All right. Here's what I want you to do, Paulette. I want you to contact me privately. I have email at artbell@mindspring.com. artbell@mindspring.com.
Okay.
And provide me with a phone number, which I will not give out, I promise you, to anybody else. And I want to talk to you, and I want to talk to Bob, and I want to follow up on this story, all right?
You know how happy that would make me, because it's something I've wondered about myself all these years, too.
Paulette, you do it. I'll do it. Thank you. Thank you very much. You get me the information. I will follow up, and then I'll follow up for all of you. Oh, you never know. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
This is Chris from Minnesota.
Hello, Chris.
And
what's up?
Hello. And boy, that's a tough one to follow.
Well, give it a try.
Two quick things before I get to my main point. I saw an interview recently with Jerry Lewis, and he apparently has this remote control device that he uses to trigger some sort of a device.
Oh, for his back. Yes, I know. I'd rather not talk about my back. Anyway, what's up,
sure,
sir?
And then the other thing is, before you leave the air for retirement, I would love to hear your Ouija board story that for all these years you've refused to tell.
And I will refuse and take that one to my grave. Anything else, sir?
Yeah. I recently was watching Entertainment Tonight, and they're doing a movie about Chuck Barris and his story, and I'd be interested in hearing it.
Oh, you're exactly right, and that movie is about to come out. I mean,
it's just
about to be released. Chuck Barris is an he did some incredible things. I mean, for television, Chuck Barris is an absolute icon. Chuck Barris is a flat-out icon, no matter what you think. And, you know, there are a lot of people, and I'm going to talk to Chuck about this. I mean, how many of you out there never saw either The Gong Show, The Newlywed Game, or The Dating Game? Now, I'm sure, like many, you have ragged criticism for that kind of television. Oh, it's trash TV. God, that's trash TV. But almost everybody watched. Almost everybody watched. Boy, he caught the critics' barbs, I'll tell you. They pierced him more than one time. So, you know, in a lot of ways, Chuck and I are going to have a lot in common. I felt the barb of the long critic stingers as they enter my body. You know, over the years, many, 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 many times, but people listen. You know, as people watch those programs, most did not admit it, of course. Well, me? Watch The Dating Game, The Newlywed Game, or The Gong Show? Please. But, oh, you bet your butt they watched in droves. As a matter of fact, at one time he had more half hours on television than any other human being on the face of the planet. And to imagine that this man, who produced this kind of, and did this kind of television, had a second secret life as a hitman. As a hitman. That's just outrageous. And we're going to be perhaps talking to Chuck in a moment, a few moments. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Not a lot of time. Hello.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've got a Rendlesham Forest, Mount Ararat, and a hitman story all connected by the Air Force. I have a good friend of mine who, when we got out of the Air Force, was a contract hitman. He was a private pilot for a major corporation, which gave him a great entree into South and Central America. And he just sort of cruised in and out on business trips and conducted his own other business.
Okay. I guess that's the way it's done.
And also, the Rendlesham Forest thing took place at RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge, split base.
You are aware, of course, that the British are finally going to release the secret report on all of that.
Yes, right. But let me tell you what they were interested in, probably. You see, the Rendlesham Forest comes right up to the perimeter of the base at RAF Woodbridge for the 78th TAC fighter squadron, my squadron.
About 10 seconds.
Okay. The nuclear alert pad is there, and all the nuclear weapon storage facilities are on that side of the base.
Wonderful. I've got to run, sir. You call me again, all right?
All right.
And we'll carry on with that. Coming up in a moment, Chuck Barry. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good morning.
Hey, life. Look at me. I can see the real sky. But when the sun comes out of my world, I won't stop. Suddenly, I just won't stop.
From west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
Top of the morning, everybody. This is going to be really different. A departure coming up in a moment. Chuck Barris. You should know that name. Chuck Barris. Jack of all trades, really. Creator. Books, music, TV. Chuck Barris has had some big hits. His rock song, if you're old enough to remember, Palisades Park, well, I sure am, received a gold record. One of his three novels, You and Me Babe, reached number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. Three of the many television shows he created and produced, The Dating Game, The Newlywed Game, and of course, The Gong Show, have become TV legends. Now, the second of his three books, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, is the premise of a coming film. The book has just been reissued. Barris is working on a sequel. Bad Grass Never Dies, More Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, to be published next year. He also just released CDs of songs he sings with his band, the Hollywood Cowboys, entitled Confessions of a Dangerous Singer. Barris is a prize-winning still photographer, recently received a doctorate's degree from Drexel University, founded the Chuck Barris Production Company in 1965 and 68. Chuck Barris Productions became the first independent television production company to go public. At that time, Chuck Barris Productions had made more television half hours per week, that would be 27 in total, that's incredible, than any other TV production company in the country. Barris was president, CEO of Chuck Barris Productions, later named Barris Industries until the company's sale in 1986. In 69, Barris Industries sold a half-hour game TV show, The Parent Game, to independent television stations all across the country, opening up what quickly became one of the most lucrative sides of the television industry, first-run TV syndication.
He's a member of the Friars Club of New York, New York Athletic Club, member of the Board of Directors of the New York Police Foundation. Harris lives in Manhattan, in Stevens Landing, New York, with his wife, Mary. In a moment, he'll be up. And there, one of the things that I'm going to say right now that he may later confirm, deny, or let us think what we will is the apparent statement in his book, and apparently to be followed up in the movie, that while he was doing all this, absolutely incredible as it may sound, while he was doing all of what I just told you about, he was a CIA hitman. We'll be right back.
All the way from New York, where he lives, here is Chuck Barris. Chuck Barris, welcome to the program.
Oh, how you doing, Art?
I'm doing just great. And yourself?
I am fine. Fine and dandy for, like, 10 after 2, quarter after 2 in the morning.
Ah, yeah, that's right. You're on the East Coast, aren't you?
Right.
All right, well, you and I have a whole lot to talk about, Chuck. What a life you've had. I mean, what a life you've had. How in the world did you come to produce things that for their time, I mean, for today, of course, they're nothing. Look at the things that go on today on TV. But at the time, the dating game and the newlywed game, those kind of things, they, especially the dating game and the doctrine, they're outrageous, totally, absolutely blinking outrageous. And so how did that come to be?
Well, you know, it's amazing that they were considered outrageous when you think about what's going on today, but they were. And I think the whole situation was that my program, starting with a dating game, were spontaneous. I mean, there weren't any answers. There weren't any correct answers. It wasn't a question and answer show. It wasn't a stunt show. Everything was spontaneous, and that was brand new. And, you know, that happened on the Newlywed Game. And everything else I ever did was a show that didn't have, you know, that couldn't be scripted. And so when you had a show that wasn't scripted, anything could happen. You know, in those days, things happened. And they were, you know, really scurrilous at the time.
And I bet a lot of it didn't make it on the screen either.
Well, you know, the first 5 shows I did were unairable, which was amazing. That was the first 5 dating game shows.
Unairable?
Unairable, because then we had these really cute little Doris Day-like girls and handsome guys. But for some reason or other, which I'll never be able to explain, when they got on the air, they just said the dirtiest things that could come to mind.
Really?
And in those days, we weren't allowed to say toilet. We couldn't say God. We couldn't say make love. We had to say, make whoopee. Where was your favorite place with you and your husband? And on the Newlywed Game, we always said make whoopee. But these kids said things that just knocked me out. I would sit up in the wee hours of the night trying to figure out what possessed them to say this stuff.
What do you think did?
I have no idea. I really don't to this day. And so in order to save the program, because I was warned that if it continued, the program would go off the air. I'm talking about the dating game.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is my first. I had to get a friend impersonate. I got an actor who impersonated someone from the FCC. And he told the contestants beforehand that, you know, they would go to jail if they said, you know, anything distasteful in the air, that these were FCC airwaves. These are government airwaves.
So what did you do? You got a guy in a suit who looked kind of...
Yeah, I had a guy in a trench coat and a hat. And that's what he did.
And so he'd be like, come on the set before the show, and he'd say...
Yeah, he would walk into the...
I'm Mr. Brown from the Federal Communications Commission, and here's the way it is, guys.
That's right. $10,000 fine and 10 years in prison for saying anything, you know, off color on a government airways. You know.
And that worked?
It worked, Art. And our programs were clean until, you know, basically clean. And then after that, years went by, and then it became bleeps. You bleeped out dirty words, out things, and so forth and so on. I mean,
how did you even convince some network executive to do something as outrageous for the time as a dating game? I mean, he must have said, are you out of your mind?
Well, it was Leonard Goldberg actually was the head of daytime programming at the American Broadcasting Company, and the show really didn't seem to be all that outrageous. Here it was a nice, clean-cut little girl talking to three guys. One guy was a handsome guy. One guy was kind of not so handsome, and some other character, and a celebrity. Well, I always try to get a celebrity in there. And she would ask him, it sounds good. I mean, it doesn't sound like that. And it was good. It was a really sweet, kind of a nice program. And everybody did it. I mean, every person out there, every budding young star or whatever did the show, and there wasn't anything really dirty about it. You can make it that way, and they have.
Have you seen Meet My Parents?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. No, you know something, Art? I never have seen any of these other shows that have been on the air since then, or they're on the air today.
You can't do it? You can't watch?
They don't move me. I mean, I don't find anything, exciting about them. But,
well, that's what a lot of people said about your shows, though.
Oh, yeah, well.
I mean, they were so canned. They were so, the critics slaughtered you. I mean, they just came after you tooth and tongue.
Yeah, well, when the Dating Game went on the air, Art, the headline in the Chicago Tribune was, "Daytime Television Hits All-Time Low." That was the first Dating Game show that went on the air. Now, I ask you.
But it hit real hard. Thing was, though, the people watched it.
Yeah, they did. I mean, of course, as you said, not many people ever admitted they did, but they did.
That's right.
Obviously. And it got worse. I mean, the criticism just, it seemed to be something to criticize. And I would, in turn bait the critics. I'd read their reviews on the air, and particularly on the Gong Show and stuff like that. But internally, it was messing me up royally. And
was it really?
Yeah. I don't know what that was from. I don't know what I was.
But didn't you balance that against, like, when the ratings came out? And television, man, they have ratings all the time, right? They've got ratings
every day,
like every day or something.
Right.
Yeah. And so, as much as the criticism might have torn you up, didn't you balance it and say, well, kind of like, screw you, look at the ratings?
No.
You didn't?
As a matter of fact, no, I didn't. And I don't know, and now in retrospect, one of the things I think about a lot in these days is, why did I take it so hard? I mean, that's kind of a wimpy thing to do, it's the heat, can't take the heat, get it out of the kitchen, and I ran out of the kitchen. I mean, after about 4 years of the Gong Show, I just couldn't deal with it. And it really crumbled me up, and I took off. I left for Europe, and I went and got rid of the company, and now...
You moved to France or something, right?
Yeah, I lived there for about 8 years.
And you left because of all that?
Yeah, I mean, it just wanted to get the hell out and get away. I really don't think that was the thing to do. I really think that was a really chicken thing. I wasn't really doing all those, the stuff wasn't that bad, and I didn't have any reason to take it that hard. And if I had it to do over again, I probably would do the same thing.
How do you feel on the general subject of celebrity or notoriety, or maybe even the word notorious would be appropriate in the way you were thinking then, anyhow? I mean, how do you feel? People should be, so many people want to be celebrities. They should really be careful what they wish for. In a lot of ways.
Well, it depends. Certain celebrities love it. I mean, if they weren't recognized in a crowd, or they would be really heartbroken. To me, I think it affects people totally differently. I couldn't take it. I don't know why. I mean, I haven't any great explanation for it. But I hated the thought that I couldn't go to breakfast in a luncheonette or a diner anymore without getting people asking questions, chasing me, or going to a movie and standing in line, or going to a sporting event. And And again, you know,
I mean, to do something as radical as go to France, to go live in France. I love Paris, by the way. God, what a beautiful city.
Yeah.
So not so bad a place to go. But I mean, to be driven that far, yeah, it must really have affected you. I'm not so wild about celebrity either. It's not near so bad in radio because hardly anybody knows what you look like. But still in all, I'm recognized even when I go to South America, it's a daggone to sing, and it I don't really like it.
Well, you know, I don't think this is a great attitude. I mean, you go up there on television. I mean, I'm speaking for myself.
No, that's fine.
Go out on television and you're out there. These people feel that they have a kind of familiarity with you, and you should accept that. And there shouldn't be anything wrong with that. And you actually should embrace it. I mean, this is what you're doing. And these people, everybody's got a right to feel that way. Why you should feel angry about it and something like that, I don't think it's right, yet that's what I did. That was the reaction I had, like, leave me alone. You know, I just want to eat my little sandwich and have a cup of coffee here.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, I think wrong. I don't know if I'll ever... you were talking about my age. I'm 73.
73?
Yeah. If I had it to do over again, I would be real friendly with everybody on the street.
Would you?
Oh, yeah. And I would, I mean, because I think I was kind of obnoxious and more than kind of. And I think that if I had to do, I just would be nicer. And I wouldn't take the criticism as, you know, that way. This is what I think. But it's funny because... you know, I'm getting reviews for the book, and the good reviews are great. But when I see a bad line in some review, I get that old feeling again.
Well, see, then you haven't changed.
Yeah.
You haven't changed.
It's a pain. I don't know.
I know. It's something that you live. I, too, live that same thing. I mean, I've been really slammed around, and I've never, even though you try and put on the face, I've never really, you know, they get me. I mean, it gets me. I read somebody who really comes after me, and it gets me. It does get to you. It goes to your soul because you're putting your soul into this. And so, I don't know, it just goes right to your soul. It's like there's no way to stop it. You put on a brave face, but really it still gets you, right?
Yeah, and it does, and it's way out of whack. I mean, you know, it's just a television program, you know. It's just a movie. It's just a book. There's a zillion other books and a zillion other movies, so what are you getting so upset about? I mean, that's the way I kind of look at it now, but it's not the way I behaved before, and that's a shame.
So it was a celebrity, it was being recognized all the time, it was not having a private life, it was having to do the show. How about doing the show itself, Chuck, when you were actually doing the show?
Yeah. For 4 years, I mean, that were the happiest days of my life. I mean, it was a subculture. I'm talking about the Gong Show. You know, I lived and breathed every day of the week with the people I worked with.
And it was
like
fun.
Camelot.
It was fun.
Fun, the best fun. I never laughed. I never had such a good time. But there was a reaction, though, that was taking place. I don't know, it was kind of a genetic ham in my family or something. Because on the stage, I was behaving like a wild man, and I'm basically a pretty shy guy, and I couldn't really kind of watch myself, but the act of doing those shows for those 4 years was terrific.
But you could feel it like a switch being thrown, right? When you started that show, you were somebody else.
Somebody else. I joke about, you know, like I was having my midlife crisis on Coast to Coast television, but it wasn't that. It was... That's a joke, and it's not even a funny joke. If some other thing got out there, I mean, I broke every rule that I told all my hosts to do all the time. I would always, you know, tell my hosts to don't be bored with it. Just, you know, the public likes a routine. You know, don't think you have to push the envelope because the show will carry you. You know, the show will go on and it'll make you a star and so forth. Well, when I went on to do the show, I thought I was boring the death out of my audience. I pushed the envelope as far as I can go week after week. And I'm convinced now, after it's all over, that high-powered television shows, the high-powered people...
They all push the envelope. The stuff that succeeds pushes the envelope.
Yeah, it pushes the envelope, but not for long. I mean, the Andy Williamses, the Donna Shores, the Perry Comos... they never pushed. They were calm, and they their programs lasted forever. Even Ed Sullivan, I mean, he just had a kind of a boring personality, but he went on forever. But the Arsenio Halls and the Chuck Barrises and those other kind of guys that are up there powerhousing it away last for about 3 or 4 years and are gone.
3 or 4 years, that's 3 or 4 years more than most people get in television.
Yeah, I guess so, but I come from, you know, the shows that I'm thinking about are shows that have gone on forever, like The Price is Right, or in the evening, you know, some of these great shows that have been on for 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 years.
Carson?
Yeah, well, Carson went on forever, and rightly so. David Letterman, they're all on there for it's been quite some time. But they're not powerhouse in that sense, you know. I was like, you know, a crazy man up there.
Yeah, you were.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, the audience was going to was really excited in the studio, and I thought that was it. I thought as long as they were excited, everything was fine. But studio audiences, you know, are not a barometer of what the show's doing.
No, a good observation. Now, hold on, Chuck. Chuck Barris is my guest. We're talking about one of Chuck's lives right now, and we'll kind of slide into another one of Chuck's lives. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
It's shiver in the dark. It's raining in the park. Meantime, down the river, you stop and you hold everything. Then it's blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, I step inside, but you don't see too many faces.
Palisades Park. Indeed, that was one big monster record. That was one of the things that Chuck Barris had to do with. And you haven't heard the whole story yet. Stay right where you are. This is Coast to Coast AM.
To reach Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903.
Yeah, speaking of long-running television shows, one of them that happens to be still running came and got Chuck. 60 Minutes, oh man, that ran a long, long time, still running actually, and they came and they did their thing, the old put it in their face and let's see them sweat kind of interview. They grilled you about demeaning people on your programs, that sort of thing.
That's right.
Tell me a story about that.
Well, no, Mike Wiles came and he said to me, you know, do I have a good time really running people through their paces and demeaning them and making fun of them on the air and so forth? And I really took exception to that because I never really thought I did that except for one show at the very end.
So how'd you answer him?
Well, I told him that, you know, I said, these contestants are having the time of their life. I think it's the one little moment that they'll always remember. And he mentioned one lady who fainted on the show because she got a prize she thought was you know, something with the prizes, and she just collapsed and fainted. And I said, I thought she still had the best time of her life. So
even though she fainted.
Well, I she fainted from joy. I mean, she just got this really an automobile when she thought she was getting like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and she just overwhelmed and fell right down and among all the cables and everything.
When they came to interview you, did you know they were going to do a job on you?
No, I didn't, you know, it was nothing that I really wanted, that I weren't worried about. And, you know, what could Mike ask me that I wouldn't be able to answer truthfully? So anyway, Mike went and went to this lady's house, and he asked her, what did she think when she fainted? And she said she had the time of her life. That's what really was the situation with everybody on our shows. They really had a good time. We never did anything really. They were even on the Gong Show, you know, they're just enjoying themselves. I did create a show at the end called Three's a Crowd, which was a show where the premise was, who knows the husband better, his wife or his secretary? And I thought that was a great premise. And it turned out to be a disaster because it was a hurtful show. And for the first time, the contestants really didn't have a good time. They weren't enjoying themselves. And the ratings were immense.
Now, see, I never saw that. I mean, did it?
No, it was on for a very short time. The ratings were incredible.
What happened? Did the secretary know?
No, the women's organizations around the country rose up, and other organizations, and that was about the time when we were really baked for everybody, and that's part of the reason that messed me up, you know, because then that show went off the air, and I realized I kind of overstepped that area myself.
You really think so?
Yeah.
How many of the secretaries knew the men better than the wives? And I suppose then wives had a sad face and walked out, and it couldn't have been a happy moment.
Oh, it was worse than that. I mean, like, the husband would come out first, and the host would say, how many presents has your secretary bought your wife?
Oh, God.
And he'd say, none, never. And then the secretary would come out, and she would say, three. I got her the 90 for your anniversary, and I got her that. And then the wife would come out and say, he better had said none, and he would hold his card up with zero, which, you know. And then the host, the evil host, would say, well, that's not what the secretary said. And the wife would crumble right on the air. And
oh, God.
That wasn't fun.
Well, you know, I guess a lot of now, boy, we're in the age of reality TV. In fact, you know, really, there's a new show called 30 Seconds to Fame, and you have to have seen that. I mean, everybody has to have pointed that out to you at least, right?
It's been pointed out, yeah, like the Gong Show.
It's just like
the
Gong Show.
And all those dating shows, there's a huge collection of dating shows, you know. And I'll tell you something, Art, I think Three's a Crowd, that secretary husband thing, today would be a huge hit. Huge.
Yeah,
because
probably.
That kind of pain and that kind of agony on television is
what sells.
It sells. I can't, you know, I wouldn't do that show. I really don't think I would, because I couldn't deal with that, being responsible for that kind of pain.
Newsweek also came to you, didn't they? They covered the Gong Show, didn't they?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think it was Maureen Dowd, I'm not sure.
How'd that go?
Well, that was great because she came out as a cheerleader, and she was great. She handled the show well, and I mean, she wrote a thing good. Everything was good for us in that interview, so that was good.
Well, the dating game came to life during the height of the sexual revolution.
Right.
So I guess I can really understand how a lot of the comments were out of bounds, way beyond what you would expect. But you really, honestly, had an FCC guy, or a fake FCC guy there, huh?
Yeah, but you know, Art, that's not true. Even though it was the '60s, that not everybody was a hippie, and not everybody, you know, not in that young adults, and even in the dating game, we had older people. There wasn't any one particular age. But not everybody, you know, was into, you know, wild, free love, this, that, and the next thing. And that's where we aim for, because we want to stay on the air. And it was that element that went berserk, and that's why we had to get that guy to come on and scare the hell out of us.
Did that say to you, I mean, did you sort of cringe inwardly thinking, this is what we've come to? I mean, you must have had private thoughts while you're doing this thing.
When that was happening?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, it was, you know, I was in debt, I was in hock, I had borrowed money to put the try to sell the show. My life was in the balance at that time, and here I got a break and I got a show on the air, and these kids are ruining it.
Out of control.
And I wasn't,
Five shows, that's a lot of shows, five shows. How long, did you do those, like, in five consecutive days or even in one day?
Oh, you mean that when we had 27 half hours?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we had five different shows, 5 days a week. Each show was on Monday through Friday. Five shows on Monday through Friday, and two half hours were on at night on Saturday, a dating game, a Newlywed game.
I'm surprised you didn't have a heart attack.
Oh, that was the best. Boy, I'm telling you, we were having fun. We were kicking a lot of butt around those days. It was just wonderful.
Well, I'm gonna have to try here now. Your shows and you, I mean, you're an icon, you're a television icon, and as with a lot of icons, it's kind of like you were forgotten for some years. In fact, I think the book you wrote went out of publication, sort of slid quietly out of publication, right?
20 years ago.
And now here the book's back, and now it's going to be a movie, and it's boom, all of a sudden it's coming back. And people think a lot of things of you, Chuck, you know, good, bad, and ugly, but the one thing they would not have thought of connecting with you in any way whatsoever would be employment by the Central Intelligence Agency. Somebody said that to me and I went, what? Yeah, I'll do the interview. I went, what? Chuck Maris, CIA, give me a break.
Well, you know, I wrote Confessions of a Dangerous Mind at a bad time, and my all the shows were off the air, and I was holed up in a hotel here in New York, and I was really living in California. I just left town, like, I held up here, and I wrote Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which tells a story. You know, it's the premise is this guy, you know, he's getting crucified for doing television shows, trying to entertain people. And meanwhile, he's getting medals and presidential citations for killing enemies of the United States of America. That's the premise of Confessions, which I wrote.
Chuck, after I thought that, just to stop you for one second, then I thought, yeah, but you know, that's exactly what they would want you to think. In other words, you would be the least likely to ever be thought of in that category, and that would make you just right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to talk about it. I wrote the book.
Well, all right, let's.
And they made the movie, and the movie is you know, with George Clooney and Julia Roberts and Drew Barrymore. It's really good. And it's opening up at the end of the year, and both those things. Well, the movie tells the story of the book.
Is that going to be a December movie?
December 31st, the movie opens up in New York and L.A. and then around the country.
December 31st, really?
Yeah, next month, last day of the year.
That's last.
But when I wrote that book, that's how I felt. And times have changed, you know. 20 years later, it's a whole new world. You know, that's the thing that's amazing about everything. Things change. They change so fast. I mean, you're down, and then you're up, and then you're down again, and you're up again, and it just keeps going on.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
That's the way life works.
2 years ago, I had lung cancer. Came as a shock. I went for something else, and I got that. And there I was sitting in the hospital room, and I'd just been divorced. I had low programs on the air. I couldn't write any books. Nobody was buying them. I mean, about as gloomy an outlook you could have.
Pretty bad.
And here it is, 2 years later, and there's the book's out again, and it's doing well. The movie is coming out at the end of the month. Married to the love of my life.
What about the lung cancer, Chuck? Usually,
beat it. That, you know, at the time when I was looking out that hospital window at the Hudson River.
Most people don't.
Yeah, I know, but it was an accident. I went in for a CAT scan for a rotator cuff, and they found it. And that's, and I'm telling you, Art, you tell your audience to get CAT scans if they ever smoke, because it, you can't find it on a chest x-ray. You'll save lives by just telling people to go out and get a CAT scan. Of course, that's what happened to me. The CAT scan caught it so early that it was just an operation. I never had to take chemo or radio or anything like that.
They caught it right at the very beginning.
Very, very beginning. And that's what, you can find that out if you take a CAT scan. So, but that whole, but the, look how life has changed. And that's not to say that, you know, tomorrow afternoon, it could be something, you know, disastrous. But it, it, Lord give us and take us away, and keeps doing it all the time. And so fast, make your head spin around. And that's what this story with Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is. I mean, here
well,
was...
Well, do you agree with that premise, Chuck?
Yes.
That of all the people in the world that you might think of as a CIA hitman, Chuck Barris would not exactly be the first name that would spring to your mind.
Well, you know, of course. There's no question about that. But I also believe in that premise, too, that you can get, you know, nailed to the cross for trying to entertain and praised to the sky for killing. That's weird.
That is weird. You're right. You, I understand that you can't talk about probably the details of that work.
That's right.
Obviously. But you did a lot of traveling, didn't you?
Yes.
So that traveling would give you an opportunity to do whatever work you had to do aside from what you were doing otherwise?
Well, I just don't want to talk about it. I mean, you know...
Well, I'm sort of stating the obvious.
The obvious situation, sure. We sent dates all over the world. We sent dates to Russia, to...
That's right.
Everywhere.
That's right. You did
and,
it at the
and
end of the
every
meeting.
Time we sent a date somewhere, there was a chaperone, and the chaperone came from my company. It was a reward for the kids that worked for me. I mean, here are these kids that are, they had to be 21 years old or older.
Right.
And they and here they these kids worked for me. I had a real young company, and they're all Californians, and they're going all over the world. I mean, they're going to Vienna and Paris, London, Rome, you know, Tokyo, anywhere you get, Australia. I mean, they were in Brazil. We sent dates everywhere.
And when you sent dates, you always sent a chaperone.
We always sent a chaperone. And then, on many occasions...
There must be a lot of stories with that alone.
Oh, there were a couple of books the kids wrote. I mean, yeah, there were plenty of stories about that alone. But I was... I'd catch a trip now and then. You know, I'd go chaperone a trip to Pamplona and watch the bulls run, you know.
Really?
Or go off to here or go off to there.
Go off to here or there, yeah.
So it was a perfect, you know, it was easy for me to do that. So I did travel a lot, and so did everybody in the company, but they were kids.
Do you think that how can I phrase this? The anger that you felt, you know, with what you were going through, enabled you to do the other kind of work? I mean, I can imagine that. I can imagine an inner seething anger that could suddenly manifest itself in some way. Huh?
Yeah, well, well, you know.
Pretty angry.
Well, I'm not so sure I was so angry. I was having a pretty good time. I was pretty happy. Things were good. It got angry toward the end, but only
people
because...
People don't, yeah, but they don't pick it up and go to France because they're real happy. I mean...
No, that's true. I had a little self-exile job there,
yeah.
Which really... I was, you know, I kind of disappointed later that I exiled myself because I couldn't understand, you know, why I did that. But
there wouldn't be any other reason for that exile, would there, that you can't talk about beyond.
No, it's just something you don't talk about. I just don't talk about that.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, Art. I mean,
no,
I don't want to be a bad interview, but...
You know, there's ways to talk about things without really talking about them anyway, and... I was just wondering, could we imagine that there might be reasons for your exile?
No, not really. I mean, you know, my basically for me, it was just wanted to take a break. I kind of lived a Walter Mitty life in a sort of a strange way. And one of my little Walter Mitty dreams was to write the great American novel in the south of France, like Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway.
Sure.
And here I made enough money to actually make that dream come true.
Yeah, you could afford it.
And at the time, boy, it was nothing. I know everybody must feel at some point in their life, it just get me out of here. And the time passes, but with me, I could do it. I could afford it, and I did it. I went to the south of France, and I wrote what I hope was a great American novel, which it wasn't. That was the bad part of the dream.
Yeah, how were those years in
They
France?
Were great.
Were they, in France, were they good?
They were terrific. I mean, I was living out a fantasy, and it was a fun fantasy, and then all of a sudden, whap, you know, I just missed the States, I missed sports, I missed the language, and I just, you know, looked up one day and said, you know, get me the hell out of here, and I went home.
Isn't that interesting?
But
I lived in Japan for 10 years. Okinawa, you know, the Far East. I lived there 10 years. And I got to the point, Chuck, where I realized if I didn't come home, I knew I was going native big time. And I realized if I didn't come home and come back to the States, that I was never going to come back. And so that's what brought me back to the States.
That never was my feeling. I had a jacket on the back which said L'Americain. And I never ever thought I would be staying in France ever. I missed the scores, you know, we got them 2 days late. And this drove me nuts to a point where I finally came home.
The scores.
You know, I couldn't get the baseball scores or basketball scores, you know. And we didn't have the internet then and stuff like that.
So were you alone most of that time, the time you were in France?
No, I was married for part of that time, and you know, I had friends there, other writers who were my friends previously who lived there and gave me the idea of going there. It was great. I mean, I lived in the south of France. I had this great little house overlooking the Mediterranean and a little speedboat, and played pool in the, you know, bocce in the town square in the afternoon, and it was fun. It was great. But then all of a sudden, like, I looked up one day and wondered what I was doing there.
Time to go home.
Oh yeah.
All right, hold it right there, and we will be right back. Chuck Barris is my guest, and we're going to get what we can from him. Game show host, producer, CIA hitman. The movie coming out December 31st. That should be interesting. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell.
Daddy was a cop on the east side of Chicago, back in the USA, back in the bad old days, in the heat of a summer night, in the land of the dollar bill. When the town of Chicago died, they talk about it still. When a man named Al Capone was trying to make that town his own, and he called his gang to war with the forces of the law, I heard my mama cry. I heard a brave the night of Chicago die.
Call Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. Yeah. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
It certainly is. As you know, I get little computer blasts on my screen here as I do the program. Steve in Johnstown, Pennsylvania says, hey, Art, you know, while you were playing Palisades Park, I was Freddie Boom Boom Cannon. I can close my eyes and I can see Chuck Barris dancing with a hat on his head, arms flailing. Chuck made me laugh till I cried many times. That's Steve in Johnstown. Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Me too. I remember it all. All right, actually, this came to me from Adam Leiter, I believe it is. I guess Adam Leiter, and he's promoting all of this, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. The movie coming out shortly. It's going to be a big one, too. Miramax Films. The all-star cast, including Sam Rockwell, Julia Roberts, George Clooney, Drew Barrymore, about the man's life that we're interviewing right now, Chuck Barris. And what was written to me was the following, with regard to the Gong Show. But, it says, in between those outlandish acts that were gonged nightly and during some of those fabulous getaway dates awarded on the dating game, Chuck was serving America in a very different way. He joined the CIA in the early 60s, remained with them straight through his tremendously successful television career. After several years of domestic work, he was sent abroad to kill enemies of the American state, claiming to have killed over 30 people. Over 30 people. Now, he doesn't want to talk about this, you know, and there's not a lot I can do about that. He doesn't want to, so we're going to just have to sort of talk about it and not talk about it, if you know what I mean. I have a question that I think you can answer, because you really brought it up yourself, Chuck, and that is, why do you think that that in America, producing silly but really fun shows is a critical sin, but killing people appears to be understood or even applauded? I mean, what does that say about us?
Art, that's serious.
Yeah, serious.
That's a heavy question. I really don't know how to go about answering that. What that, you know, that's very complicated.
Yeah.
Silly shows.
So I said silly but fun.
I know. You know, whatever. Trivial, silly, fun.
Entertaining.
Entertaining people. I think this is a small, number, not the big population that we have out there. I think they just don't want to acknowledge the fact that this is a kind of show that can entertain them. It's a personal thing. It has to do with their own evaluation of what they think of themselves and so forth. I think that's really ridiculous, because on the Gong Show in particular, people always say to me, I never watched that show. I just never watched it. I mean, but when you had that act on with such and such, all of that was, you know, it was so telling.
Yeah.
How that has to do with you know, you take, then you move over to the other area, killing people.
Yeah.
It's done by our, armed forces. It's by our law and order people. It's never a great thing. It's a necessity to defend our country, defend our cities. But what does that tell you? That you get ridiculed for entertaining and medals
for light entertainment.
For light entertainment, yeah. Medals for killing. Well, killing is valor in most situations in our country. And I don't know what that has to tell you about the American people. I don't think it tells you much of anything about them, other than maybe they're just a little too embarrassed to say they like a silly show. I don't think it gets much more serious than that. That's my own opinion. I mean, I think people can delve into that and make what they want of it. But to me, it's just living. I mean, we've got to do one thing, we've got to do the other. We've got to entertain, and we've got to defend. And life goes on, as the Beatles say, ooblah-dee, ooblah-dum. I don't know what else to say about it.
There are those, Chuck, who would say, I don't believe a word of it. You know, what I believe is, I think that I believe what Chuck said. I think he was hurt to his soul by the criticism that he got for what he did. Hurt so much that you ran away to France. Hurt so much that you made this up to, you know, to counter the other image.
I'm to respond now, right?
if you can find a way to.
Well, it's something I just don't talk about. That's all. I mean, I don't talk about the
But you did.
The truthfulness of this to my wife, to my family,
sure.
to anybody else. This is something that only I hold in my head, and that's where it'll stay.
And by the way, let's talk about that for a second. Let's assume that all of this really did occur. That's a lot to hold in your head and your heart and your soul. That's a lot to hold in. No matter the reasons you may have done it, no matter that it was, you know, for the good of your country, and we all know, God knows, it goes on. We do it like everybody else does. Nobody should imagine for one second that we don't, because we do. We kill. But, I mean, that's a lot to hold in, isn't it?
Yeah.
Would be a whole lot for anybody to hold in. And how do you think that's affected you?
Well, listen, every one of us lives these lives of at times, you know, desperation.
Yes.
You and I and your listening audience, everybody else, and we all have our problems, and that's all in our heads, and we hold them in however we choose to hold them in. Some of us just go off the deep end. Some of us manage to deal with it. That's a personal thing. How I hold it in, I don't know. I think that I've gotten through life, you know, pretty good. But you might line up six other people and say eight versions of what I just said. It's hard for me to say.
Yeah. You know, usually writing a book about this kind of thing would... it might even be a death sentence. I mean, to write of this sort of thing, to even speak of this sort of thing, one can imagine just wouldn't make some people happy somewhere.
Yeah, I imagine that could be true.
You think that might be true?
Yeah, I think that... I think it's something I just don't want to talk about.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's why I'm keeping it so general. I'm just saying that.
No, you're doing a very good job, and you're
did you
really good.
Did you worry about that at all? I mean, that you might make some people.
I'm a worrier, Art.
So
I worry about everything.
Yeah, I do too. Total class type A personality, right?
Yeah, major. I mean, major. You know, I worry about my wife, whether she's dressed warmly enough. I worry about what's going to happen with the book. I worry about what's going to happen with the weather, whether United Airlines, I'm going to be able to fly out there to California with them. I read somewhere that they taped a wing on with a piece of scotch tape. I don't know if any of that stuff is true, but I'll give them plenty of grounds to worry about.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a worrier.
So when you wrote this book, did you worry?
Well, you know, when I wrote the book Confessions, which I think is, I kind of really think it's kind of good. I mean, I read it recently. I wrote it 20 years ago. I read it recently, and Jesus, I was amazed at how funny it was. I mean, and entertaining. But when I wrote it, I was in some other place, and I, you know, in writing the sequel, I try to get that back, but that was a different place, and at a time of my life when I felt like writing this damn book, and now I'm not there anymore, and it's different.
Were you surprised that at the time, are you surprised now, it'd be a better question, that at the time it didn't do as much as it's doing now? I mean, here it is roaring back to be a movie and all the rest of it. This is wild. Why do you think that's occurring?
There was a review in Publishers Weekly that said 20 years later it's a classic. But it also said in that same review that it wasn't the right time, and that I was enmeshed in all... Well, I'll tell you this, Art. One of the reviews back then, 20 years ago, was what can you expect, talking about the book, what can you expect from the guy who gave us The Dating Game and The Newlywed Game?
Yeah.
So there was my journalist, my novelistic career compared to some kind of a Dating Game, Newlywed Game, nasty
comparison. Couldn't possibly be good.
Yeah.
It was a different time, and I was at a different place, and the whole, I mean, that was...
Maybe you were always ahead of your time. I'm sure you've thought about that a lot. I mean, with the shows that you had ideas for, with what you were doing, it's not good being too early. It's good being early, but it's not good being too early sometimes.
Well, it's not good at all. I consider a lot of the stuff I did being ahead of my time, but I also consider them to be failures, because being ahead of your time, in my opinion, is not anything to be proud of. Being right on the money is something to be proud of. I mean, when you can do a show that's a book or a company, or you create whatever you create, if it's a time for it to happen, great. If it's you're ahead of your time, you might as well be behind the time, because it doesn't mean anything.
Huh.
And that's how I've always considered being ahead of my time, and I have. I know I have. But it amounts to a big goose egg as far as I'm concerned.
Well, when you reflect back on it all, would you really go back? I mean, you said earlier you'd be so different. Do you really think you'd be? I mean, even today, I hear in you what you described was in you back then. So it doesn't sound to me like you'd be
old. No, you're right, Art. I mean, I think that what I'm saying is I would like to be. After going through all this and learning things I've learned, I would like to go back. If I got back, I would like to be this other kind of person, because I think it's a better person.
But you probably wouldn't be, though.
But I wouldn't.
Yeah. Toward the end of the Gong Show, you said you did ridicule. What happened toward the very end of the Gong Show? I mean,
at the end of the Gong Show, I think that a lot of stuff was coming to a confluence. They were just converging I was tired. I was fatigued. The shows were going through a bad time. The country was not, the country was going through a pretty clean time. Jerry Falwell was chasing me. and these are for shows that, that I was doing at that time. And, I was doing the Gong Show, and it was a murderous schedule. And one day I was standing on my mark waiting for a commercial break. And, I watched the audience. They were going crazy. The band was having, screaming and yelling, and I just had it, broke out into a sweat. And I was standing there, and the makeup girl was trying to pat me down. And I said, I don't really, I would just love to just quit. She said, why don't you? And I said, well, and I did.
What did Jerry Falwell say about you? He's come after a lot of people. Oh, believe me, Jerry. Jerry typically goes out and he says something so intolerably outrageous and then ends up apologizing for it later. How did he come after you?
Well, we just were the devil incarnate, whatever that means. I think that we weren't. The stuff I was doing was just not airable to Jerry. And, it's funny because at that time, I'm talking back in the late 70s, it was what he said, carried a lot of weight. Now I think if, at all due respect to Jerry, if he said something was bad, it would probably be considered good for the program. Times changed, and they keep doing it. They just keep doing it. It's amazing.
Wild as that was, anybody ever die on that program?
Yes, we did have some lady die on the Gong Show.
Oh,
she was
really?
In the middle of singing Havana Gila, and she just dropped dead.
Oh my God.
Her husband said afterwards that if she had a choice of a way to go, that was it.
So she went happily, according to him?
Yeah.
That must have been. What did you do with that? I mean, did the news get out at the time, or?
Well, actually, it was. She finished her song, walked backstage, and then died.
So you aired it?
Yeah, but we didn't see her die.
I understand. So you aired the segment, though. Where
yeah, but when that lady on that other show was telling you about collapsed from joy, I wasn't sure whether she died or not, and I was wondering at the time whether it would have been good for the ratings or not.
Would you have pushed to have aired it?
Yes. Yeah, I think I really would. Now, it didn't happen, and I don't have to worry about a judgment. But if it did happen, I was really happy to see her jump up. I mean, that was a relief. But, you know, I don't know what I would have done.
If she had, well, apparently you do. I mean, you would have, you'd go ahead and dare it.
I guess so.
Yeah. This movie that's going to come out, maybe there's another way I can ask you about this. The movie that's about to come out after Christmas.
Yeah.
Great time to release any movie, by the way. When we go to this movie, have you seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you've seen it. Okay, good. So when we go to this movie, should we imagine, other than a little bit of, no doubt, literary, you know, license, which I'm sure they took, that the most of what we're seeing has great basis in truth?
Well, I would suggest that you don't think of it as any literary license one way or another. I think you just go to see the film and walk out after it's over and say to yourself, you know, could that be or could that not be? I think you judge for yourself. That's the way I'd want it. I'd want everybody.
Yeah, but we've got you to tell us. I mean, should we imagine that what we're going to see in that movie has basis in truth?
I can't tell you that. I mean, I can't discuss that. In other words, you're telling me, is it true? You're asking me to answer the question.
No.
And I wouldn't tell my wife it was true or not.
No, I'm just saying that I'm asking whether there's some germ of truth in it, some basis of truth in it.
Art, I love your show. I love you. I can't tell
you're not
you.
Gonna
I
answer
can't
that,
tell
huh?
you about that. I'm sorry.
Then when you wrote the book, which I haven't had an opportunity to
write. Oh, you've got to get it.
I will.
I'll send it.
Actually, you know what? I'd love to have an autographed copy.
I'll send you one tomorrow.
Would you really?
Or today, actually.
Will you really?
Absolutely.
All right. You know what, then? We're coming up on a break, so what I'll do is I'll pick up the phone during the break, and I'll give you my private address, all right?
I'll take it. I got pencil ready.
Yeah, good. Stay right there, Chuck. Chuck Barris is my guest. Actually, as you listen, you've got to admit, a very, very, very complex man. Pretty wild stuff. Tomorrow night, by the way, Stephen Greer. Then Friday night, Saturday morning, Dr. David Jacobs, who's also a pretty complex, in fact, those are complex men, all of them. From the High Desert, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. But once again, Chuck Barris. Chuck, that really is a very, very intriguing title for, you know, even a book or a movie or whatever, Confessions of a Day. Do you think that you have a dangerous mind?
Oh, I think, yeah, I do. I think a lot of people do. I think probably you might.
Yeah, I might.
It's hard to say who does and who doesn't.
But you do.
You know, Art, I'm afraid it's like 20 or 4, and I'm afraid I'm getting kind of sleepy. But here's the thing. I think that as I get weaker, I'm going to say things that I don't want to say.
Well, that's good.
And I think maybe, is that an ulterior motive?
No. Yeah, that's right. We slowly put you in a different state, Chuck,
yeah,
until finally you blurt it all out.
That's what I was thinking here during the break.
Well, let's talk about a dangerous mind. What do you mean by a dangerous mind?
Dangerous mind.
Yeah.
You know, I without, I'm not a big psychoanalytical whatever. It's just that everybody, I'll speak for myself.
Yeah.
You have these thoughts. I mean, I have these thoughts. They're imaginative. Sometimes they're full of fantasy. Sometimes they're, they're dangerous in a sense that they could cause havoc to friends and loved ones and strangers, and they couldn't. I mean, it's all in perceiving certain things that are happening and how you react to them.
Don't you think
the old saying, I could kill that guy.
Yeah, that's right.
I'd break his head off or something in a moment of anger.
Absolutely.
Well, who knows, you know, what people are thinking. And
Don't you think it goes with a very creative mind, Chuck, that very creative minds, type A personalities, these are all, you know, they lend themselves toward also dangerous and dark thinking at times.
Well, you know, you can't tell. I mean, sure, I agree. But I think, you know, they could be mentally problematical, I guess you would say. For instance, like, we had a guy on a gong show whose act was pressing a plate glass, a clear piece of glass against his face and making these wild, strange faces, yeah, which were very funny. And the guy was a demolition expert, a Vietnam veteran, wacky, and was sent to a VA mental hospital and threatened my life because he felt that I ruined his career.
Really?
Imagine that career of pressing your face against glass.
Did you gong him?
He was gonged, yeah, and that's gone. Why he claimed that I was
ruined.
So who would have known? This nice little guy standing there pressing his face against glass. This guy has a dangerous mind. They're all over the place, unfortunately.
You do get a lot of threats.
Oh, yeah. I guess because, in a sense, I mean, the gong show dealt with a certain amount of the lunatic fringe. I mean, these people were creating acts. I mean, there was the majority were just terrific. But there was this fringe group that were creating these funny acts from these mentally whacked out minds,
mm-hmm,
that went up on the stage, and they were funny, or they were, you know, they were gongable or what have you, and they were airable. But they came from very strange minds. And the group, the stormtroopers, or whatever we used to call the kids that saw the first wash of people that came in, they were just some of them were really dangerous. And in that sense, I think there are a lot of dangerous minds wandering around.
Yeah. Very, very, very unusual people. Yeah, you're right. I mean, in my audience as well, the great majority of them are quite literate, quite interested in learning the truth about the kind of things that we talk about here. But there's also, of course, the lunatic fringe. They're always there. And so if you deal with them, at least in part, you tend to get threatened a lot. And you have to be very careful because it could go to more than that. It could be more than a threat. You could get killed.
Yeah, you can. I mean, that's not unusual in I guess in show business with all its variations. But
in general, yeah.
That you open your doors up, to the public in this kind of offbeat, weird sort of way. Like,
that's
what
right.
kind of ridiculous thing can you do on our show that'll be funny? One of the things that used to amaze me is when they got to me. And they were still really not arable. I would just talk to these people. I'd say, you know, what possessed you to think of this act? I mean, why did you think this would be arable on Coast to Coast television? I was just amazed at their thinking.
Well, do you think it's generally true that a large segment of the population, or at least enough of the population, will do anything at all to have FaceTime on television or whatever?
Yes, I do. I don't know what percentage that is. It's a small percent.
Why do you think that's so?
It's your 15 minutes. It's that that the strong desire of everybody I always thought it was everybody wants to let their friends, their family, the people they associate with, the guys at the office, see them on television, see themselves on television in some form or other. And it's just 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but boy, they can live off that for a long time because it's just something that happens in their life that they remember.
I guess.
And I think, you know, people lie, steal, cheat, and do anything they can to get on television. We had people do the dating game who were on a wanted list.
What?
I mean, a guy was, a bachelor, one of three bachelors was wanted by the police for some crime or something, someplace. He couldn't resist going down and crying out for television.
So what if I go to jail? It'll be worth it.
So it's not unusual. And I don't think it's so wrong. I think everybody just wants to do that. I mean, every contestant that ever did our shows generally loved it and remembered it as having a lot of fun.
I love doing this program. When I'm doing the program, when I'm actually doing the program, it's the love of my life. It's my soul getting bared. I'm in a zone and I love it, but I hate what comes with it. I don't like the fame. I don't like the celebrity. People try to interview me all the time, and I tell them to go climb a tree. I don't do interviews. I want a private life. I don't want my private life intruded upon. And so I love the show, and I hate what it brings. You understand that, I guess,
yeah,
don't you?
I sure do. Yeah, no, but you know something? It's wrong. It's wrong for us, for you or for me, to feel that way, I believe.
Probably.
Paul Newman, I read somewhere, I don't know if this is true or not, doesn't give autographs, he just refused. And I decided that at one point I would be like Paul Newman, I would refuse to give these autographs because they just were annoying.
Yeah.
And I was walking along Fifth Avenue one day and this guy walked up alongside me and he said, "Can I have your autograph?" And I said, "No, I don't give autographs." And he said, "I have a pencil and paper right here, all you have to do is sign." And I said, "No, I don't do that."
Yeah.
I felt him drift away, and then he was gone. And about 2 seconds later, I thought, "Oh, the hell with that!" And I turned around, and I went, and he was gone. And I just wasn't around. And I really felt badly about it. So I think there's something inherently wrong about hating the stuff that comes with your celebrity.
Yeah.
It's you know, nobody told you to go do that.
Nope.
Nobody told you to make your radio program.
Nope.
But you're doing it,
yep.
And what you take with it, you should really be able to enjoy it. Now, I don't know if I could go back and do it, but that's what I think you should do.
Have you ever thought about that, going back and doing it again? I mean, you could. My God, you know, if I didn't know that you were in your 70s, to me, you sound like you're in your 30s, your 40s to me. Now, that's probably a trained voice staying with you. I don't know what it is, but you don't sound like you're your age.
Well, I don't know if I look it either. I think that's all well and good, but going back and doing that stuff, I would never do television again.
Really?
I don't think there's anything that I would do again that I did except write, because writing, at least you're by yourself, you're alone, you don't have any bosses telling you what's good and what's bad, you don't have any conflicts or stuff like that, and that I can deal with. But going back to, you know, I tried it. I went back once, and everybody, all the people I spoke to were about half my age. They looked like kids. They didn't know. I mean, I was kind of like some fossil. I was out of it, or as they said, I was out of the loop.
Yep.
And it wasn't any fun being out of loop. And I also had this feeling that they thought I was old. And that's not a great feeling. And who wants to go through that again? Besides, you need another kind of personality for that. You got to be ready for that. I couldn't go up there and
be
do that
crazy,
what I did
be
before.
The crazy man again?
No.
No, huh?
No way.
When you wrote the book,
yeah,
you... Because I've written four now. When you wrote the book, you have to relive it. I mean, it makes you relive it. Even if you don't put it all in the book, just thinking about it to write the book makes you relive it, right?
Yeah.
How did you do with that?
Well, that's not easy. I mean, it can put you through moods. You know, the good parts, that's great. You get a big kick out of doing that. The bad parts, it's tough. It's tough. And sometimes, you know, it's a masochistic thing. I think writing in general is masochistic. I think that anybody wants to go live that kind of life, you should let them go, because don't try talking to them, because it's a ridiculous thing. You're alone. Life is going by outside your window while you're sitting there writing these books, and these books seldom get read. I mean, you know, when you're dealing in television, you're dealing in 20 million people in the audience. You're dealing in books. You're dealing with 30,000 books. It's like, it's almost ridiculous after 2 years. And sometimes you don't even get them published. But the point is that you're reliving, you're creating a life that's not yours. And you're living it vicariously through your book. And that's kind of, that's kind of odd.
Now, again, do you think that if that which you will not talk about tonight had truth in it, that writing a book and getting it published would put you in a safer place once it got published, once it was out there, once it was public, once it was all laid out, sort of, that it would be safer for you?
I never even considered that.
No, huh?
No. I never thought about safe or unsafe. I never considered anything, you know, like that. It just was something I had to get out of my system. I put it down, and it's out there, and that's it. The consequences, if sometimes if I would stop to think about consequences of things that I've done.
Oh, yeah.
From hosting shows to whatever.
Whatever.
It would scare you to death.
I'm sure it would. You were, where were you when the whole thing with Dick Clark and the ABC scandals and the payola and all of that occurred?
I was out of work, and I was really unemployed. I was out of work for about 6 months. It was a long stretch for me to be, out of work. And I got a job. I kept going around the networks because I had been in a management training program at NBC, and I went around. I had a kind of a background that I could try to sell, but I couldn't get a job. So I went to ABC one day, and that's just when the scandals hit. And they needed somebody to go down and bird dog Dick. They needed ABC's solution to the problem of payroll and all that. Well, so Dick wasn't, accused of anything. They right. just wanted to make sure he was protected so that they could say they had done something. And I was the guy they hired to send down to him.
What was your job?
I mean, my job was to watch Dick. It is the silliest thing you ever heard at the time. But
you were supposed to watch him?
Well,
I mean, what were you waiting for? Some envelope to get, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My job was to be there when Dick started his working day till Dick finished his working day and just see that everything was
so that if called upon, you could go in front of some committee somewhere
exactly.
and say, hey, I watched Dick, every exactly. day, all day long. Nothing ever happened, I can assure you.
That's right. And then somebody would say, well, how about night when you went home? And then I wouldn't know what to say. But that was neither here nor there because I didn't question it. I needed the job.
You needed work.
You bet. So, I got that job. And then Dick and I became friends because Dick knew that, that this was a life preserver to a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
And we remained friends for, it's been almost 50 years, I guess. And that's where I was during that whole thing.
You remember the game show scandals?
Oh, very well. I was working at NBC at the time. I was in their management training program, and I remember when Van, what was his name? Van.
Oh, it was a $64,000 question.
Yeah, he went down for the count, and I saw him. His face was pure white that night that he was. I think he was being nailed that night. I remember it was in NBC.
Did you see the movie Game Show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that, do you think that was representative of roughly the way it came down?
Yeah, I think so. The only thing I didn't like about that is sort of made heroes out of the guys that were throwing the shows. But I think that's basically, from my limited knowledge, I was one step up from a page. I think that was about the way it was.
Did you know what was going on?
No, not at all.
No rumors?
No. Not a bit, but I don't know why I would, because I was way down the ladder. I mean, I didn't know. I just knew where to take,
I imagine it was bad days at Black Rock there, huh?
Oh, that was bad days in every place, because, all the game shows went off the air. And then that followed after that, the record scandals, and then a lot of DJs lost their jobs, and it was a bad time.
Well, in your shows, the shows you did, The Dating Game, and particularly The Dating Game, how much of that was all rehearsed? I mean, was
you know, you know, nothing was ever rehearsed.
Nothing?
Nothing on any of my shows was ever rehearsed.
No, you never went to anybody and said, here'd be a great line.
No, Art, remember, I came from the networks. I was a veteran of the payola scandals and of the game show scandals.
Yeah.
And I knew as an entrepreneur, as CEO of my company or whatever, that I had to be perfectly clean because I saw what happened to people that weren't. And I didn't want to lose my shows or lose, you know, my start in the industry. So I was perfectly, perfectly clean. And a dating game, not one thing was rehearsed. A Newlywed game, not one thing was rehearsed. And I remember once NBC had two FBI guys checking out game show producers.
Really? Hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. Listen, I know it's 4 o'clock almost where you are in New York. And so I always give my guests an opportunity to either bail or stick out the final hour. Can you stay the final hour?
Oh, geez. I hope I don't fall asleep on you.
Yeah, well,
I'll try.
Maybe you'll sort of drift off into some little land.
Yeah.
All right, Chuck, stay right there. Hold on. Chuck Barris, Dating Game, Gong Show, and That Other Life. He's my guest right now, and, you know, this is good bumper music. You think about it. You listen to it very carefully. It's all about people and why people do things, the kind of things they did on those shows. And I don't know what the answer is, but they do them.
Sweet dreams are made of these. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something.
Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach out on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
It is indeed. My guest is Chuck Barris. Dangerous Mind. What do you think? You've had quite a chance to listen to it tonight. Do you detect in the edges of what Chuck is saying that just might be true? I do. What do you think? Well, first of all, you've seen the movie yourself, so give me your impressions of the movie.
It's really good.
Really?
It's hard for me to be really objective because all I'm really concerned about is how's the audience perceiving me.
Yep.
But you know, Sam Rockwell plays me. He's a young new actor, and he's remarkable. I think he's great. And George Clooney directed it and stars in it, and I think George did a marvelous job. It tells a good story. The bottom line for me is when the picture's over, I'm proud of it. I'm not, you know, there's nothing about it that I'm ashamed of or anything like that. And I think it's just plain outright entertaining. That's all there is. I mean, it's been getting great critical reviews from the early critics, and I think everybody's going to enjoy it.
Gee, the critics are being nice to you?
Yeah, that's not a change. Now, that's what I mean. Things change.
You know, actually, I mentioned the movie. It was a quiz show, not what I call it. It was a quiz show, was the name of the movie.
Yeah, the quiz show, yeah. And, that's right.
And so you think that was pretty accurate. You think, boy, that must have been one horrible time at the network. Do you remember once it hit what it was like there?
Oh, yeah. It was more or less like that picture depicted it. It was completely pandemonium around the networks. I mean, they were just crazed with what to do and what not to do and how to cover their backs. And,
yeah.
You know, various programs were expendable because they weren't billing that much. Others they wanted to keep, and they didn't know how to go about keeping it. It was bedlam. And, you know, people had their careers ruined, and some of them came back, but it took them years to get back.
Well, then along came finally, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and a lot of other shows now, and so they're back.
Yeah, they are.
You think there is a possibility of the same kind of problem cropping up again with a new crop of game shows?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, he had that Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and stuff like that, but I don't think so, because I think now, because of that, I think there are safeguards that our watch disclaimers and standards and practices personnel that just watch the networks carefully to see that just doesn't happen again.
Now, I'm watching, I'm a reality TV watcher, and so is my wife. We both watch it, and there's several of them we do like. But what I'm noticing is, here's the current trend, Chuck, just in case you're really not watching anything, and that is they're going further and further and further and further. It's some of these game shows put people in actually fairly dangerous but perhaps somewhat controlled conditions. But one of these days, there's going to be something awful that's going to happen. I have this terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. And I wonder if you've seen that. I mean, they're pushing it really to the edge with these shows now.
Well, I haven't seen the shows, so I know what you're talking about, like Survivor and things like that. But the thing that it amazes me now, the thing that I'm a tad scared about, is the direction it's going as far as taste and,
yep.
You know, for instance, I mean, there's a show called, that I've heard talked about called The Will, and it's where people are opposing members of the family are fighting each other over a will of some
oh my God,
dead member of the family.
As a premise of a TV show?
That unquestionably. I mean, that's it. And,
oh,
and it goes further and further toward that. Years and years ago, I predicted or said, and I was being really facetious and more jokingly, that in the end, you know, executions were going to be televised because that's the ultimate. And the ultimate game show in my that I had devised only as a gag, only as a joke, but it got finally attributed to me as a real
idea
that I really wanted to do, was a game called Greed, which there was, but that's not the one I wanted to do, in a little boy and his dog would come out and the contestants would bid down to see how little money they would take to shoot the dog. Now, that's in front of the little boy. Now, that's, you know, horrendous, but that's the direction I thought television was going. And if you can't tell me that a program that argues, two families arguing over the will of somebody deceased.
Well, it's not that far away then, is it?
Isn't that, they're doing autopsies in England. I mean, they're doing a show in which somebody performs an autopsy. Now, how far away is that from that horrendous idea I had, you know, years ago?
Maybe we're like the Romans. Maybe American television is like, you know, the Colosseum days in Rome.
Well, I don't think it's just American television. I think most of these ideas of these reality shows came from Europe.
Actually, I think that's right. They did, didn't they? I mean, Big Brother, I think, began.
Survivor and that Millionaire and all those shows, they're basically European ideas. And they have worse. I mean, there are shows in Europe, game shows that I don't even know if I couldn't describe that are further out than that.
Really?
Yeah, but, you know, it's the violence. You know, I'm not a prude. That, I think anybody would probably agree to that. But the violent direction that some shows are going is, to me,
amazing, you know, just rather mind-boggling.
Well, there's one called Fear Factor. Have you seen that?
I saw the teasers for it.
Well, it's one of the ones that keeps going a little further each time. It's like it's going to be a little more dangerous, and I realize they keep controls, you know, they got cables on people and stuff like that, but it's getting pretty far out there.
Okay, so go back 100 years to when I was doing this treasure hunt show, and the lady fainted, and I didn't know whether she died or not, and I was wondering in my mind at about 20,000 miles a second whether it was good that she did or bad that she did. I mean, do we show it or do we cut away from it or whatever? And then move forward to where they're actually, you know, is the motive of a show that's pushing its contestants to the point where there's a life is at risk?
Yeah.
Is that on purpose? Is that something that that the networks are sophisticatedly trying to do? I don't know, but in my little opinion, it is.
Well, I mean, look, we've got police shows that do nothing but show chases that end either with disfigurement or death. And,
right.
And I don't know what the premise is that we get away with that, but that's what we show. I mean, it's exciting, and that's what people seem to want to see. And again, begs the question, you know, about... I guess us, you know.
Well, it's all ratings, and imagine a show that has a fatality and the potential of another fatality following it in the weeks to come.
Yes,
I cannot believe that would not be a huge rating booster, and that show would get enormous ratings with the potential of tuning it in some night and seeing somebody die. And if what you're telling me is true, where these shows like The Survivor or whatever shows you're mentioning are pushing contestants to the point where they're really risking, they're getting a little more dangerous, that to me would be a logical conclusion.
Well,
because ratings are the name of the game. And the show that has the biggest numbers of homes gets the biggest advertising budget, you know, and it goes on and on and on from there. It makes sense.
It wasn't Survivor, but it was an offshoot of Survivor, and a man on a bike trail did a flip and had a branch of a tree go right through his chest. And they, you know, that he could have died, and they showed that, and I'm presuming that had he died, they'd have shown that.
Yeah, so I wouldn't doubt it in a million years, and I don't know whether that would have been a cause of jubilation in the networks. I mean, this sounds awful, but maybe it's because I'm tired, but I still think that networks, their race for ratings and their greed for ratings are pushing shows to the point where, and it would be acceptable, there are certain acceptable reasons for a death to happen on television.
That's incredible.
You know?
Yeah, no, that's incredible. Was it like that was a politics? I mean, I watched Quiz Show fascinated with the politics of the network. Was that depicted reasonably, do you think?
Oh, it's always been that way. It's just that it's the same thing with me back in the 60s where I couldn't say toilet seat or making love.
Yeah.
The politics of language and of objectivity. What are you trying to accomplish? How are you going to get the biggest number of ratings? The $64,000 question got enormous ratings, and so they cheated to keep those ratings going. This is old shoe for network television.
Anything for ratings eventually?
In my opinion, yes.
Even death?
In my opinion, yes.
I want a few people to get a few people in here and let them ask you questions. First time caller line, you're on the air with Chuck Barris in New York. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm pretty good. Where are you?
I'm in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Okay.
Quite an honor. You know, every time I watch a football team where a team's really poor at home,
yeah,
they always have people with sacks over their heads. And it always reminds me back to when I was 6 or 7 watching your show with the guy that came out with a sack over his head.
Yeah, the unknown comic. Yeah.
Oh, that was hilarious.
Yeah, he was
that
great.
About? Who was it?
He's still around. His name is Murray Langston. And the reason he wore the bag was he was a comic in L.A., and he was trying to make his way career, and he was too ashamed to come on the Gong Show. He didn't want his buddies to know that he was doing the show, so he created an act where he could come on with a sack on his head. And he was hysterical. He was really a funny guy, and he could never take that sack off his head, so he never was really known.
And when he did, he always had a sack underneath it.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, thank you very much. This is something that I've wondered about, Chuck, with like 30 Seconds to Fame, which is sort of the modern version of the Gong Show. It has to be true that some of those acts, and so I'll ask you about your show in the Gong Show, some of those acts you knew well beforehand absolutely flat out were going to be gongs.
Oh, no question about it.
Right?
Absolutely. We remember the premise of the Gong Show was, you know, I went out to do a show of really good talent. I couldn't find any. All I found was bad talent.
Yeah.
So I decided, why waste it? We'll do it the reverse. We'll put bad talent on with a couple of good acts. But we knew we would program acts that we were sure would be gonged. But you know something, Art? It didn't always work out that way. Some acts that we were sure would be gone, they let go, and it amazed me. But we certainly programmed them to be gone.
So every now and then they surprised you.
Yeah, but we never fixed an act. I mean, we took the act as it came, and we said, this is so bad, it's got to get gone. And, you know, and we had a rule that they could play for 45 seconds before they could get gone. That's where the other show does 30 seconds
to fame, yeah.
So, because that established the act. But once the 40-second time was up, those guys hit those gongs quickly, and we thought they would.
In 30 Seconds to Fame, I think they gave the contestant who wins $25,000. In the dating game and some of your other games, you didn't give great giant prizes. And when your show became gigantic, when you could have afforded to give really gigantic prizes, I mean, you could have raised the bar on the prizes big time. You really didn't do that. How come?
Well, for instance, you take the Newlywed game. If we'd have raised the ante above a washing machine or a refrigerator, those Newlyweds would have killed each other. They would have been, you know, literally manslaughter on a stage. I mean, if we put a little yacht up there, a little sailboat or a new car,
yeah,
and some wife got the wrong answer, it wouldn't be funny. The only way to keep those people funny and to keep them light and cool was give them something that they could, you know, they were Newlyweds, so give them a prize. But if we got expensive, it didn't work. On the Gong Show, we didn't care about the money wasn't the point of the show. You know, we gave them like $120 if you're a winner or something like that. I did a show called the $1.98 Beauty Show, which was a takeoff on beauty pageants, and we gave them $1.98 and a bouquet of dead flowers to the winner. So prizes were, to me, you know, not the reason.
You didn't have to do that.
We couldn't on the Newlywed game. That was, I'm telling you the truth. They would have really hurt each other. They would have been so angry at each other. God knows what they would have done.
But yet they still come on and embarrass each other for cheap prizes.
Yeah, well, you know something? Marriage. You know, we were right on the money as far as marriage was concerned. 50% of the couples that did the Newlywed game ended up being divorced. And I think in the country...
Oh, my God, really?
I think in the country, it's not far off from the norm. I think the country goes about the same way. I think 50% of marriages end in divorce. I'm not sure about that, but in our show it was.
And was it per? Did you keep stats? In other words, fairly real?
Yeah, basically we could. We could do a medium statistical number that wasn't. It didn't have to be a huge number.
Wow.
But you know something? Most married couples do not respect each other. And another aspect of it is that most married couples, the couples that do have respect for each other, aside from love, but respect, never did the Newlywed game. So we had couples that coming in, you know, only the minority really, you know, had a great love or respect for each other. The others didn't care. They were young, they were newlyweds, and it was a really condemnation of marriage in a sense.
Did that work on you? I mean, did it work?
No, not, you know, my own, whatever problems I had were my own, but the whole point of marriage to me was that, you know, these kids were getting married, they weren't just taking it that seriously. It's a serious thing, and you got to really, you know, it's a fragile situation. These kids never thought about it as being fragile.
Isn't that interesting? Very quickly, Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Chuck Barris. Hello.
Hi, Chuck. This is Dave and Christopher. I was wondering, the flavor of the shows that you put together were so different then that it seemed like a very original idea. Is it possible that they were created actually by the company as a vehicle for use further down the road to get their operatives?
No. No, the programs are only created by me, and I was trying to just get on. I was trying to get into television with a television idea. I had come from a background at the networks of game shows, and I was trying to think of something that could get me a show on the air. And the only thing I could think of that was different from what they were doing was something that was spontaneous.
Yeah, but you can see, though, that the company would look at your program and say, hey, look, they're sending people all over the world. They're sending people maybe even to Moscow or whatever, and with chaperones. Gee, we could provide a chaperone. Now, company might do that, huh?
Well, if you read the book and see the movie, you'll answer those questions.
All right. Hold on, Chuck. We're here at the bottom of the hour already. Chuck Barris is my guest. TV, a TV legend, to be sure. I'm Art Bell from the High Desert. We'll be right back. Once again, from New York, where it's crawling up on 5 o'clock in the morning, here is Chuck Barris.
Well, I can't believe I'm still here.
Really? Well, it's not that hard to do.
Are you kidding? This has really been fun. I mean, this I can't believe I've been on for this long.
Is there any, like one word or several words you would sum up your whole career with when you think back on it now?
Well, that's a good question. Geez, I don't know why lucky comes into it.
Lucky?
I think that it's been, it's just been kind of, I'm going to write that down and think about it. My first word comes out as lucky.
Lucky.
Prep. I feel like luck and preparation and something else I can't remember right now.
There's always talent. Yeah.
Well, it's
always talent. I mean,
timing.
I understand
timing.
What
it's
you
luck,
say.
Preparation, and timing, and I've just always, for the most part, been able to hit on those things. If you get the luck and the timing,
yeah,
you better be prepared. And so if I could sense that I was coming up on something like that, I would prep for it. But then again, it can twist on it. It can change, and your timing can go right off.
I've noticed that a lot of artists say luck, and they actually carry a little bit of guilt about the amount of success they've had. But they're usually wrong about that. Luck part is talent. Usually it's talent. It's really talent, but they don't think of it that way.
Well, yeah, I know. I never felt that. I never felt guilty about anything like that. I think when you work hard and get that, there's the luck and I think in timing are almost the same thing.
Wanda in Escondido writes on the computer to me, hey Art, tell Chuck I watched all his shows and I loved him, and most of all the Gong Show, and I'll bet he was laughing all the way to the bank while the critics were blasting his shows.
That's true.
You were?
Yep. Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. They were blasting the shows and I was going to the bank,
And
that offset the blasting.
Yeah, that offset the blasting. All right, on my international line, you're on the air with Chuck Barris. Where are you calling from, please?
Calling from Busan, Korea. Good evening.
Yeah, well, hi there in Korea.
Korea. It's a good morning for all of you, an early morning for others.
Yes, sir.
I'm just giddy as a schoolgirl right now because I'm talking to two people that my mother considered to probably be the most dangerous minds in America. she blames Chuck personally for destroying the innocence of my youth, And you aren't for the things I would discuss at the dinner table in high school. But just for a reference point, I was born in 69, so if you're 7, 8, 9 years old, you don't want to ask your mother what making whoopee means. It's not a pleasant result, and that's from that day, the newlywed game was outlawed on our television. But I had one anecdote that I wanted to share that just locked me into the Gong Show as a youth. I used to run home to watch whatever cartoon was on and occasionally drift over the channels and catch some of the Gong Show. And loved Murray Langston. The guy was responsible for some really idiotic things I did as a child that my parents, again, didn't approve of. But the one day when I just said, I've got to watch this screw cartoons on the Gong Show, was there was, I can't remember exactly the details. There was a woman in a Native American outfit of some sort with a vest and a feather, I remember. She was doing a dance and had literally nothing on underneath that vest. She got gonged, and I remember J.P. Morgan saying, this time, do it without the vest.
Yeah,
and
well,
from that, I mean, it was, now I had to watch the Gong Show every day of my life after that.
I always thought that fans like yourself, who were really loyal to our program, were a little odd.
Yeah.
And not twisted, a little bit, but good. I liked it, you know, but I could always tell. They were just a little different than everybody else.
Well, right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Chuck Barris. Hello.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen.
Hello.
I'm probably a little bit odd, too, for having to bring this one up. But
it's okay.
My girlfriend and I laughed so hard last time Art asked Chuck, well, I think what the most embarrassing time in his experience on the newlywed game was. I think something to do with having to change the format of the cards after that, and maybe it had to do with Whoopi and where Whoopi was the most weirdest place.
Oh, yes.
Can we hear that one more time, just for old time's sake?
Not on this show, you
know. Oh, Art, please.
No.
Well, just ask a little bit of it, or
All right. I think probably most people by now know what it is. It was actually revealed on national television here. I don't know, the last several months, somebody did it. Do you recall who that was, Chuck?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
The most embarrassing moment in the
newly... That you made whoopee with your wife?
Let's not answer it here, because...
No, it's in the movie. Go to the movie.
Oh, you do have it in the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
Go to the
movie, please.
I just want to clarify, you know, when I said, you know, odd, and I meant in a good way that
sure.
These people were just... I would see a Gong Show fan, I'd say that's somebody like, in my own heart, they were just a little different than
weird.
normal viewer.
Oh, I'm totally weird. I'm completely weird. Maybe it's the only way you can do this kind of thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Chuck Barris. Hi.
Hey, good evening. It's a pleasure.
Where are you, sir?
I'm on top of the mountain on Highway 76 in Pennsylvania in the middle of a blizzard.
No kidding.
Yeah, I heard.
Listen on WABC.
Yes, sir. I heard it was getting pretty nasty back there.
Yep, I'm gonna shut it down anytime.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, this was kind of interesting. My uncle was a starring actor out of the Ben Bard School in Los Angeles, and he was on The Dating Game, and I believe that he said that he was paid to be on, and then later he was on The Gong Show and also received some compensation for that. And I was wondering, did you guys just pull starving actors out to act as fillers sometimes?
Yeah, you know something, we never went out and you know, put anybody on the show because they were a starving actor, but it did give starving actors a lot of opportunity for jobs, because if they were an actor, they got paid scale, you know, they got paid whatever they're after, or SAG or something, and we'd pay them, which always was a pleasure to me, because you know, a lot of guys got their start and really got their food, you know, for a while doing some of our shows. It helped.
A lot of starving actors out there, aren't there?
Oh, there are. There are.
So then you really, and still are. So you really did help them out.
Well, it was always kind of nice. I mean, I don't know if we really did it on purpose, but when we found out that, you know, the guy would come up to us or the girl and say, you know, thanks a lot. That was really great. And then if we knew they were there, they were available, we'd try to put them on another show.
Oh, that's great. That's really great. So there was some interaction between shows.
Oh, yeah. You know, we're never allowed to use the same act twice on a show or the same person twice.
But if you got a really good one, there wouldn't be anything.
Well, it didn't have to be the same show. They could go up. Well, sometimes they get married, come back and do a new game. If they had a crazy act, they'd go on a gong show. You know, they were intertwined.
Oh, boy. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Chuck Barris. Hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Yes, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Fredericksburg, Virginia, below the Mason-Dixon line. There's 4 inches of snow in the Cotton-Picking area. It is really colder than blue blazes. I don't believe I'm doing this, and my kids are going to be embarrassed when their 78-year-old dad are on the most eclectic radio show I have ever heard.
It is eclectic, yeah.
I'll tell you, and I had my own show for 7 years. I thought it was pretty good, but nothing like yours, Art. This is fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
And Mr. Barris.
Yes, sir.
What would you suggest to an individual today to help them find a way to get into the TV or the radio media?
Oh, boy.
Besides stepping out of the box.
And remember
the fact that there are only two places we could be in the world. One's in heaven, one's in hell. We are not in heaven. Therefore, with the other place availability and the open-mindedness that is permeating our country, what would you suggest for that young person?
All right, well, you know what? Even a better question or a better way to ask it is, would you even suggest to anybody, Chuck, that they get into broadcasting, whether it be radio or television or the performing arts? What do you say to somebody like that? Do you warn them?
Well, you know, it seems to me, yeah, I warn them because it's a tough, I can't think of anything tougher than being an actor or in the performing arts and auditioning. I couldn't do that in a million years if you put a gun to my head. I just don't have the wherewithal to withstand rejection like that.
But I mean, even going to do what you did. I mean, if somebody said, look,
yeah, but times are different then. I mean, it's impossible to get work now, but in those days, show business was run in television, movie, by a lot of show business people, and they were more prone to take their chances with people. Nowadays, the companies are run by lawyers and accountants and businessmen.
Yep.
And you really, if I was going to get into show business today, I'd go in as a lawyer, or I'd go in as you know, something like that. Your chances of success are far greater, and your openings are much more. But because if you look around, the venues are closing down, and there's really not, you know, not that many. In one sense, the cable is burgeoning with new ideas, so that's probably where I'd go. I'd try to find myself, link myself up with some cable company or cable station, and get my start there.
You'd warn them though about the path. I mean, it's one hard path. So a lot of heartaches and more losing than winning.
Oh, you're not kidding.
All right, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Chuck Barris. Hello.
Hi there, Art. This is Dave over the hill from you here in Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, yes. Hi.
Hi. Great pleasure to talk to Chuck. Read his book about a year ago. Really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
I thought it was really offbeat and a great read. Sure. Question whether or not it's going to be as faithful. Will the movie be as faithful to it? Will characters like the Popsicle Twins be in it?
No, the Popsicle Twins aren't in it, but most everything else is Charlie Kaufman wrote the script, George Clooney directed it, and they kept it really kind of faithful to the book. I was, kind of surprising to me because, sometimes those things take a left hook, but they stuck close to the book.
Were you close to the movie while they were while it was scripting and then the whole process? No, huh?
Not really. I didn't have any reason to be. I mean, it wasn't contractual or anything like that. But Charlie wrote Charlie Kaufman wrote the script, and George, when he directed it, he would, you know, talk to me, and he was more than welcoming me up there where they were shooting in Montreal, California, and Mexico. But I never had a real contribution in the sense that they
they wanted to hear from me.
Yeah.
It was all there.
But they did come to you, though.
Yeah, they did. When they weren't afraid to come to me, and I was more than happy to help them.
It must be something to have a movie done of your life. It must really be something.
I mean, yeah, it's mind-boggling. There's no way to describe it, really. It's a totally internal thing, and that's why I said earlier that it's hard to make a judgment on my part of whether, you know, how good or bad the picture is, because all I'm sitting in there and just in awe of the fact that this has come to life. It's hard to really explain the feeling.
Let me try this question on you. How much of that which you refused to talk about tonight will be in the movie?
Well, the stuff that I don't want to talk about, I still don't want to talk about.
No, I'm not asking you to. I'm saying.
I know. But you're asking it sideways, and
yeah,
it's okay.
Right.
I don't blame you.
Well, you saw the movie, so I mean, is there quite a bit?
The movie's the same as the book. You know, if you read the book, see the movie, you got the whole story.
All right. First time caller line. You're on the air with Chuck Barris. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. Where are you?
I'm in great northwestern Lower Michigan.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
This is great. You know, great going back and remembering all this. Love the Unknown Comic. Love Gene the Dancing Machine. Love the Is So Lonesome in the Saddle Since My Horse Died. That was great. Still is great. never had a clue that Chuck Barris was so big and responsible for so much. All that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, Art, thanks for the overnight show. Great live interactive.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Just be listening to trash without this, you know.
Well,
haven't heard anything about Chuck's, you know, childhood background. Just wanted to keep it.
Oh, you know, you're right about that. I suppose we should have done that right at the very beginning of the show. Chuck, he's right.
It's a quickie. I was brought up in Philadelphia, born and bred, raised there from, you know, zero to about 18 when I finished college. And I just left college and I went to work as a trainee at NBC, and I figured that's where the action was going to be in television. That was back in the 50s, and that was pretty true. And I just rose from there. You know, I just worked my way up from there. It was really simple. I had a great childhood. I mean, I was out in the suburbs, Ballotkin with Pennsylvania.
Is there anything, though, that was in your childhood, I mean, there usually is, that launched you to do what you did?
Not a bit. Not a thing.
No.
I mean, my father was a dentist. My mother was a mother. My sister, we didn't have any background in anything like this, you know. And I just went off. I really didn't have any... I didn't have any goals. I didn't have any aspirations. My family never pushed me in any way. I wish they had. Maybe in retrospect, I don't wish they had, because it turned out pretty good.
Was your family shocked by your book, and or do you think they will be shocked by the movie?
Well, both my parents are gone, but my parents wouldn't have been shocked if they were alive, because they never got shocked.
No, anybody in your family?
Well, yeah. Yeah, my sister is, and I'm close to my sister, and I know she's shocked. But my family, my mother and father, were very, they were kind of self-centered. They didn't give me too much direction, and I don't think anything, I think they would have been pleased, definitely pleased, but, you know, nothing surprised them. My sister is practically in a coma. She doesn't know what's going on as far as, you know, this is all a surprise to her.
In the stuff that
I don't want to talk about.
Yeah, in the modern world, do you think there's as much reason and cause? I mean, if we are now post 9/11, of course, that assassination is a justified action on the part of our nation. That's a general question.
What was the question again?
Well, I said post 9/11.
I follow.
Is assassination a justified action?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The president, I believe today, or yesterday, declared that the CIA is allowed to kill Al-Qaeda. The
there was an executive order 29333 or something like that that Reagan instituted that said there will be no more assassinations of foreign whatever. But this has been apparently rescinded by the president. I do believe it's a necessity. It's got to be. It's tit for tat. I mean, you can't fight a war without this kind of war, without this kind of stuff.
Well, it would appear as though we have an enemy who really doesn't want a lot from us, despite the fact that they're probably picking up on the Palestinian question. They really, that's not really the central core. They just want us dead, pretty much. And
yeah.
They want us to die, and there's no bargaining here. They just want to kill us, and so, I mean, I don't know how else you deal with somebody who wants to kill you other than to get to them first.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Very, very quickly, because we're out of time, one last question. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Chuck Barris. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, we only got a sec, sir, so...
All right, first, I just got to quickly say, Chuck, you're a genius.
Thank you.
And I think one of the shows, I don't know if you've mentioned it, that you've definitely influenced is the David Letterman show.
Yeah.
I would say with you you did have various crew members perform on your show, correct?
That's right.
And I know that's something Dave loves to do, just bring out, see what you can find in just the regular people working around the office.
Yeah, well, David did our show as a judge. He was a judge on the Gong Show for in his early career before he really got started.
How about that?
And, NBC was kind of pushing him on various NBC programs, so he worked as one of our judges. And I think he learned a lot on that show.
All right, listen, you're not going to believe this. Wait, we're out of time. That's it, man. We're done. Confessions?
All right, let me shoot in quickly. It was a pleasure.
It's really been a pleasure. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, the book, the movie, it's all right there. Everybody go check it out. Chuck, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.